In this video, we're going to be discussing romantic literature as illustrating the role of philosophy and art from chapter 12 of Leonard Peikoff's book, Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. Stay tuned. All right, so let's start out with a summary. So Romanticism, we start out with, is a 19th century artistic movement, and it's known, we get, for its passion, its drama, its color, its emotion. But the root of emotion from the objectivist perspective is value judgments. And as Leonard notes, those have their roots in choice. And so Leonard says, what these artists rejected was a single tenet, determinism, on which naturalism was later based. They rejected the idea of man as a puppet, whether of God or society. And so this is why Ayn Rand defines Romanticism as the school of art based on the fact that human beings have free will. And so Leonard goes on to look at two aspects of Romanticism, the type of story and the type of characterization that is distinctive of the movement. In terms of story, we get that romantic literature, romantic stories are plot-driven. And Ayn Rand defines plot as a purposeful progression of logically connected events leading to the resolution of a climax. And so in order to show that people are moved by values, you need to see them actively pursuing existential goals in the face of obstacles. The series of actions have to be logically connected. Each step necessitates the next until you reach the climax, which resolves the conflict. Why is plot so essential? Because that is what shows that life is ruled by values rather than by accident. So the way that Leonard puts it is the plot implies that life is logical in the sense that a man's choices are what shape his fate. Turning then to characterization, for the best romantic authors, they show volition in regard to both existence and consciousness, in action and the formation of character. In Leonard's words, it's that these writers are moralists. They are concerned not only with values in the sense of concrete goals, but also with moral values, i.e. with the kinds of choices that shape a man's whole approach to life. And that this is distinctive of the best of the romantic writers, of the Dostoevskys, the Rostands, the Hugos. We don't just get in romanticism that the characters are committed to certain values. We get why. We get their motivation. To achieve this, romantic writers essentialize and stylize their characters. In Leonard's words, out of the chaos of contradictions that make up most people's souls, the author selects and stylizes certain attributes, presenting them in purer form than they exist in average men. The resulting characters are larger than life. But this doesn't mean that they're symbols or floating abstractions. They are at once abstract and concrete. They're universal and yet unique. And unlike naturalists who record men as they are, the romanticist projects values. He projects man and life as they might be and ought to be. But we get that romanticists were hobbled by their lack of philosophy, and in particular the ethics of altruism, which meant that they could not present, or couldn't usually present, a convincing hero. Nor could they push back against the philosophic attacks on romanticism, and that meant the real death of the school. So, a few recommendations before we get started. Obviously, we have the Romantic Manifesto, where Ayn Rand talks about romanticism. She also talks a lot about these concepts in The Art of Fiction, which is an edited transcript, as it were, of her fiction workshops. But by far the best scholar on romanticism and objectivism is Tor Bukman, and especially his course Principles of Drama, which you can buy from the Ayn Rand Institute e-store, and his contributions to the Robert Mayhew collections, and especially his chapter, Rand's Literary Romanticism, in the Blackwell Companion. So all of those are super highly recommended to understand Romanticism and how it works. But I also want to stress, you can't really understand Rand's aesthetics and certainly her analysis of Romanticism and other competing schools if you haven't consumed a lot of literature of Romantic, Naturalist, Classicist literature. So if you want a good place to start, I will recommend two sources. So one is Leonard Peikoff's 8 Great Plays, where he goes through and really teaches you how to analyze some of the best plays, not all of which are romantic, indeed some are classicists, that have ever been written. And in addition, Lisa Van Dam's Read With Me. Lisa and I did an interview where she discusses Read With Me, but essentially she exposes you to some of the greatest literature, and it's in effect a kind of like at your own pace book club that you can do. And the literature spans far beyond Romanticism. It includes great works of naturalism and great works, potentially of classicism, great works of just great works. And these will really give you some suggestions on what to read and help you appreciate them and help you understand them. If you're at all like me, many of these works, it takes a lot of effort and a certain way of approaching them that is not obvious, and it's certainly not taught in school. So it's really helpful to have an expert like Leonard or Lisa to help you unlock the value of these works. So let's dive in, though, to the actual content. And I want to first say a few words about Romanticism's relationship to Rand's theory of art. It's important to get that Rand's philosophy of art and her case for Romanticism are related but distinct. So if you read the introduction to the Romantic Manifesto, part of what she says is that basically the manifesto comes at the very end, and the rest is laying the philosophic groundwork that entitles her to argue for the school that she thinks is the greatest, Romanticism. And note even that Leonard, the way that he puts it is, he's not making the case for Romanticism, that indeed it's not really philosophy's place to be making the case for Romanticism. He's using it, and he's using Romantic literature in order to illustrate the role of philosophy and art. So that this is really more in the way of an illustration of how, by understanding Romanticism, we can see philosophy and art than it is the objectivist defense of Romanticism. Now, all art, if it's really art, concretizes philosophy, and that's why you can't make coextensive with a philosophic account of art a defense of Romanticism. And as we'll see when we get to the final section, like, non-romantic art can be aesthetically great art, but romantic art is important because A, its distinctive metaphysical value judgment, free will, is true. And B, it allows the artist to express his personal values via unconstrained creativity, so outside any kind of like authoritarian rules that you get in classicism. And therefore, C, it's the school that has the potential to combine the greatest aesthetic values with the greatest philosophic value. Let me put that in maybe some less abstract language. Romantic art is the most capable at its best of giving us the spiritual fuel we need to pursue our values. Here's how Ayn Rand explains it. And here, this is in the context of her essay, Bootleg Romanticism. And she's talking about specifically thrillers, but the point is wider than that. She says, "The generalized abstraction of a hero permits every man to identify himself with James Bond, each supplying his own concretes, which are illuminated and supported by that abstraction. It is not a conscious process, but an emotional integration, and most people may not know that this is the reason of the enjoyment they find in thrillers. It is not a leader or a protector that they seek in a hero, since his exploits are always highly individual and unsocial. What they seek is profoundly personal, self-confidence and self-assertion. Inspired by James Bond, a man may find the courage to rebel against the impositions of his in-laws, or to ask for a deserved raise, or to change his job, or to propose to the girl he loves, or to embark on the career he wants, or to defy the whole world for the sake of his new invention. This is what naturalistic art can never give him. So let's talk a little bit about free will and romanticism. So Ayn Rand defines romanticism, as we said, in terms of free will. And, well, I'll just speak for myself. When I first encountered that, I found that really baffling for many reasons, but certainly it was not obvious what a focus on free will, how that was connected to kind of the conventional features of romanticism, like emotion and the individual. And that's why you have to keep in mind, I think, the link that Ayn Rand really establishes, both in objectivism, but even more specifically when she's talking about romanticism, between free will, values, individuality, emotion. And volition here, it's stressing that the individual chooses his or her own values. They aren't determined by nature or by nurture. And it's not just that they choose their own values either, but that their choices and these values shape their character and their course of their life. So in Opart terms, it's not just that man has free will, but that free will shapes his life, that free will is efficacious, that man is a being of self-made soul. And so the conventional descriptions of romanticism, like, they're not wrong. It is the school of emotions. It is the school of individual expression, where the artist's values rather than classicist dogmas rule. But Rand's point is that the root of all of this, the essential feature, is the view that man has free will. He chooses the values that will constitute his soul, and it's these values that determine the course of his life. So then let's talk a little bit about some of the features by which romanticism actually does this. And in particular, I want to highlight the connection to values and free will. So first, to plot. So we often think, or at least this was how I certainly had kind of picked up the idea of what plot was from the culture, that was in effect a coherent storyline. And it's like, the contrast would be something just purely episodic, where random stuff just happened. Again, this is the kind of thing that is more plausible if you haven't read naturalism or other schools. But then what I remember being struck by the fact that Ayn Rand said Anthem had no plot. And like, this was, it wasn't episodic. Like, there was a real series of events and you could trace them. But it's that she is a very, you could think of it as a term of art, what plot is. She defines it, as we said, as a purposeful progression of events, and it's where the main characters are pursuing a purpose. That's what the core of what a purposeful progression of events is. And purpose here does not just mean like an intentional action. So, you know, if Joe asks Larry out, like, that's purposeful, but it's not a long-range purpose, or at least it's at most indicative of one, potentially. But by itself, it's not a long-range purpose. It's not a purpose that's shaping the course of somebody's life. And another way to put that is, it's not, what purpose means is a commitment to some value. So it's a commitment to some value, a particular lover, a career, a virtue. So if it wasn't just asking somebody out, but I'm committed to a relationship with Larry, and then I encounter a bunch of obstacles that I fight through in order to make that happen, now we're dealing with purpose. And then there's another sense in which it's purposeful. So it's the characters are driven by purposes and long-range purposes that they're going to fight through in the face of obstacles, but it's that the author is purposeful and that he or she constructs a logically connected structure of events based on the character's commitment to those values. Now, Torah, I believe this is in the Blackwell Companion, he points out an interesting paradox here, how having each event proceeding logically, inevitably from the previous events, highlights volition, Because you'd think that kind of like inextricable logic, isn't that counter to the idea of volition? But here's how Torah puts it. I'm going to quote him at length because I think this is so insightful about why plot is so connected to the Romanticist concern for free will and values. Torah says, "It is a means of showing actions that follow from values, or more precisely, of showing them as following from values. Take Galt, obviously from Atlas Shrugged, who values the pursuit of rational self-interest, his own concrete life and happiness, and his self-esteem. It is not true that if a man holds these values, he will quit his job and make others quit theirs. Speaking generally, no particular action follows logically from a moral premise or other long-range value apart from context. For instance, a brave man might logically draw his sword, but only because he was attacked. To show the connection between values and action, a writer must therefore establish both the relevant values and the requisite contexts. And the context for a literary event is the preceding events of the story." And then he goes on, "This is the reason why Galt quits only when the voters at the motor company, and more broadly the intellectuals and politicians setting the terms of society, demand that he sacrifice himself. Given the circumstances, quitting and calling the strike is the only way he can preserve his values. But what causes his action is not these values in isolation, but the values in combination with the immediate story context." So let's summarize. Romanticists want to project values, chosen long-range values, and plot allows them to do that by showing characters pursuing long-range goals in the face of obstacles, in the face of conflict, where that conflict logically necessitates a specific course of action. The character's fidelity to his values is highlighted by the fact that any other action in the face of that conflict would amount to the repudiation of those values. So it's absent conflict, the meaning of an action isn't obvious because the value motivating the action isn't obvious. And that's why there's a focus on plot. You get the long-range action, and the conflict then highlights the value and makes the progression inevitable. So let's turn then to characterization. Rand describes characterization as the presentation of the nature of people. So this is how she puts it in The Art of Fiction. "Characterization is really the presentation of motives. We understand a person if we understand what makes him act the way he does. To know a person well is to know what makes him tick, as opposed to not seeing beyond the superficial actions of the moment." Now, the conventional answers you get, like, you know, from Hollywood to why a person acts the way he does, it's usually some conventional event from the past. Like, why is Janet a detective? Because someone killed her father. But again, Romanticism is the school focused on values. And so characterization in Romanticism is really about highlighting a character's abstract value premises that are motivating them by expressing them in action and in dialogue. And this entails, I think, one of the most significant challenges that romantic writers face. It's that you want to present characters, and we noted this in Leonard's in the summary of Leonard's remarks, characters who are moved by abstractions, embody abstractions, and yet they come across as fully real, unique individuals. Now, typically, if you look at like how characterization is thought about and done today, it's like, we'll throw a bunch of accidental concretes onto a person, right? It's like, oh, this person feels real because they have some unique quirk. Like, they like filming videos of plastic bags flying around or something like that. Or I think Torah gives some examples of like a stutter or a regional accent. But for romanticists, characterization means finding distinctive concrete facets of their character that stress their value premises. And Torah gives the example here of like Rourke's sensuousness, the way that like he runs his hands over the buildings that he's building, which is really relevant to somebody who's an architect and shapes matter into buildings. Or Galt's serenity, which comes from a man who's created a new moral code in which the evil is seen as impotent. So it's in this sense that Romanticist characters are consistent. It's that every element of them is consistent with their value premises. As Rand notes, however, in her words, this does not mean that a character has to hold nothing but consistent premises. They have to act consistently with their premises, but it doesn't mean they have to hold consistent premises. And she goes on to say, some of the most interesting characters in fiction are men torn by inner conflicts. It means that the author has to be consistent in his view of a character's psychology and permit him no inexplicable actions, no actions unprepared by or contradictory to the rest of his characterization. It means that a character's contradictions should never be unintentional on the part of the author. All right, so I was going to make some comments about style, but instead I thought I want to read a selection from a book by Nathaniel and Barbara Brandon written in the very early 60s called Who is Ayn Rand? Because it's not easily available. And in one of Nathaniel's essays, this one on Ayn Rand's literary method, he has this discussion of Ayn Rand breaking down the subtleties of her own writing. Because, you know, it's one thing to try to grapple with what kind of mind, you know, creates John Galt or Dagny Taggart or writes Galt's speech. But then when you get how much went into every single paragraph, it's like the equivalent in my mind of the Steve Jobs stories about like the, what's going on inside the computer and just being concerned with every little detail being integrated towards your vision of a product. So we're gonna start with a paragraph from Atlas Shrugged. This is after Dagny has come back after going on her kind of like own mini strike before she knows about the actual strikers. Clouds, so this is the lines from Atlas. Clouds had wrapped the sky and had descended as fog to the wrap of the streets below, as if the sky were engulfing the city. She could see the whole Manhattan Island, a long, triangular shape cutting into the invisible ocean. It looked like the prow of a ship, the prow of a sinking ship. A few tall buildings still rose above it like funnels, but the rest was disappearing under the gray-blue coils, going down slowly into vapor and space. This was how they had gone, she thought. Atlantis, the city that sank into the ocean, and all the other kingdoms that vanished, leaving the same legend in all the languages of men and the same longing. And so then Brandon goes on now to say, Ayn Rand's analysis of this paragraph is as follows. And so this is a long quote from her. This description had four purposes. One, to give an image of the view from Dagny's window, namely an image of what New York looks like on a foggy evening. Two, to suggest the meaning of the events which have been taking place, namely the city as a symbol of greatness doomed to destruction. Three, to connect New York with the legend of Atlantis. Four, to convey Dagny's mood. So the description had to be written on four levels: literal, connotative, symbolic, emotional. The opening sentence of the description set the key for all four levels. Clouds had wrapped the sky and had descended as fog to wrap the streets below, as if the sky were engulfing the city. On the literal level, the sentence is exact. It describes a foggy evening. But had I said something like, there were clouds in the sky, and the streets were full of fog, the sentence would have achieved nothing more. By casting the sentence into an active form, by wording it as if the clouds were pursuing some goal, I achieved the following. One, on the literal level, a more graphic image of the view, because the sentences suggest the motion, the progressive thickening of the fog. Two, on the connotative level, it suggests the conflict of two adversaries and the grandeur of the conflict, since the adversaries are sky and city, and it suggests that the city is doomed, since it's being engulfed. Three, on the symbolic level, the word engulfed strikes the keynote for the tie to Atlantis, suggesting the act of sinking and by connotation blending the motion of the fog and the motion of waves. Four, on the emotional level, the use of so quiet a verb as to wrap in the context of an ominous engulfing conflict establish a mood of quiet, desolate hopelessness. quoting again from Atlas, she could see the whole of Manhattan Island, a long triangular shape cutting into an invisible ocean. This sentence is a literal, realistic description, but by the words cutting into an invisible ocean, I prepare the way for the comparison in the next sentence. I mention the word ocean as another link to Atlantis, and the fact that it is an invisible ocean does two things. It conveys the density of the actual fog and suggests the symbolic, legendary meaning. It looked like the prow of a sinking ship. A few tall buildings still rose above it like funnels, but the rest was disappearing under gray-blue coils, going down slowly into vapor and space. Here I allow my purpose to come out into the open, but since it is prepared for, it reads like a legitimate, unforced description of a view. Yet it accomplishes the following. 1. In the literal level, a good description of the view of New York, since it is specific enough to be sensuously real. 2. On the connotative level, a few tall buildings still rose above it suggests the heroic, the few lone fighters holding out against that to which all the lesser elements have succumbed. 3. On the symbolic level, the tie between a sinking ship and sinking city is obvious. Disappearing under gray-blue coils applies equally to coils of fog or to the waves of an ocean. Going down slowly into vapor and space is my integration of all four levels slanted just enough to make the reader notice it. The word vapor still ties the sentence to the literal description of the fog, but the thought of going down slowly into space cannot actually apply to the view nor a sinking ship. It applies to the destruction of New York and to Atlantis. That is, to the vanishing of greatness, of the ideal. 4. The emotional mood is obvious. This was how they had gone, she thought. Atlantis, the city that sank into the ocean, and all the other kingdoms that vanished, leaving the same legend in all the languages of men, and the same longing. This is the conclusion of the description, the cashing in sentence. It is not brought in arbitrarily, but sums up the meaning of the elements which to the reader has been given in the preceding three sentences to form in effect the following impression in the reader's mind. Yes, I see why she would feel that way. The above are merely the main considerations that went into the writing of this paragraph. There are many, many other considerations directing the choice and placement of every single word. It would take pages to list them all. As an example, let us take the last sentence and try to rewrite it. Suppose I change it to, "This was how Atlantis had gone," she thought. This would have been jarring and artificial, since it would have picked up Dagny's thoughts too conveniently and directly to the subject of Atlantis in the form of a fool pat sentence. The words with which I actually began the sentence, "This was how they had gone," she thought, serves as a bridge from the description of the view to introspection to Dagny's thoughts, and suggest that the thought of Atlantis came to her suddenly, involuntarily, by emotional association, rather than by conscious deliberation. Suppose I reduce that sentence to a mere mention of Atlantis and nothing else. This would have left the real meaning of the whole paragraph to implication, a vague optional implication which the reader would not necessarily notice. By saying, "and all the other kingdoms that vanished," I made my main purpose explicitly clear, that the paragraph refers to the lost ideal which mankind had always been pursuing, struggling for, seeking, and never finding. Suppose I had ended the sentence on leaving the same legend in all the languages of men. That would have made it merely a thought of a historical nature, with no emotional meaning for Dagny and no indication of the emotional cause that brought this particular thought to her mind. The interpretation of her emotional reaction would then have been left at the mercy of any particular reader's subjective inclinations. It could have been sadness, fear, anger, hopelessness, or nothing in particular. By adding the words "and the same longing," I indicated her specific mood and the essence of her emotional reaction to her present situation in the world, a desperate longing for an ideal that has become unattainable. Suppose I rewrote the end of the sentence in different order, thus, "and all the other kingdoms had vanished, leaving the same legend and the same longing in all the languages of men." This would have placed the emphasis on the universality of the quest for the ideal, and the fact that it is shared by all mankind. But what I wanted to emphasize was the quest for the ideal, not in its universality. Therefore, the words "and the same longing" had to be featured, had to come last, almost as a painfully reluctant confession and a climax. No, I do not expect the reader of that paragraph to grasp consciously all the specific considerations listed above. I expect him to get a general impression, an emotional sum, the particular sum I intended. A reader has to be concerned only with the end result. Unless he chooses to analyze it, he does not have to know by what means that result was achieved, but it is my job to know. No, I did not calculate all this by a conscious process of thought while writing that paragraph. I will not attempt here to explain the whole psychological complexity of the process of writing. I will merely indicate its essence. It consists of giving one's subconscious the right orders in advance, or setting the right premises. One must hold all the basic elements of the book's theme, plot, and main character so firmly in one's mind that they become automatic and almost instinctual. Then, as one approaches the actual writing of any given scene or paragraph, one has a sense or feel of what it has to be by the logic of the context, and one's subconscious makes the right selections to express it. Later, one checks and improves the results by means of conscious editing. So that is definitely a masterclass in style, and hopefully it's not too intimidating. I find it quite intimidating as a writer, but should be more kind of like, this is an ideal worthy of striving for. So that's it for this video. Tune in next time when we will have our last commentary on OPAR discussion. Until then, be sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel and go to donswriting.com and sign up for the newsletter. Talk next time.